Welcome back from deep inside the Death Star. I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
And welcome back to Defrag. So we want to start out today. We've got one clarification that we should make. Mike Grass wrote us. I noticed that the comments for the latest episode indicate that EFS is available on all SKUs of Windows 7. While it's certainly true that you can access or decrypt existing EFS encrypted files on all SKUs, only Pro, Ultimate, Enterprise allow encrypting of new files. Yeah, so we were unclear on the air,
and I thought
I cleared it up in the comments, but there it is. It's out there now.
Yeah, so only the higher-end SKUs can create EFS files.
But any SKU can read them.
Which is important.
It is important. I find that key to be able to view your files, yeah. Next, we had a comment from Dale. He was glad to see that you're a Diet Dr. Pepper drinker, so I just wanted to get that out of the way. And in my my lens cup, I have Diet Mountain Dew, so yeah, but I have nothing against Diet Dr. Pepper. And Lens Cup is from Deal Extreme, if you're interested. So, Andrew Richards, can you do a segment on 3-gig drives, in particular, what you have to check on your motherboard so that you can boot from one in light of the usual 2.2 gigabyte MBR limitation?
I think you mean the 2.2 terabyte limitation.
Terabyte, I'm sorry. It's typing fast.
Yes, not a big deal.
All right.
Yeah, so you're probably noticing a lot of newer higher density drives coming out.
Yeah.
And yes, it's more so in the high-end market, the enterprise market.
So this wasn't even a problem until just the last year or so, because we didn't have 2 terabyte drives.
As a consumer drive, no. I mean, you basically maxed out at 2 terabytes.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's 2.5 terabytes and 3 terabyte drives. Especially.
Not the way anymore, so.
Yeah, they're becoming really important now. You know, the larger density drives will actually take about the same amount of power as, you know, lower density drives. So in huge data centers, you want that data density.
Mm-hmm.
The big problem is, of course, how do you utilize it, right? Now, the way that Windows generally works when it comes to drives is the lowest common denominator. What is the minimum thing that I need to do to get this drive working, and not only working in the current OS, but so that previous OSs, any OS, can access it regardless?
Yeah.
Which basically means the max that you can usually format to is 2.2 terabytes. So you're wasting, you know, approximately 800 gigs.
Can you have multiple partitions that less than that, and then it can be read on other machines?
Yes, you can definitely do that. But if you want to, you know, utilize the entire 3 terabytes, or if you're using it in a RAID array or whatever, you want to make sure that you're utilizing all of it. There's a bunch of caveats to do that, but it is actually totally possible to do today with Windows 7 client. It's just not easy or readily easy.
Yeah.
So some of the things that you have to have on your checklist first is, you know, 64-bit version of the operating system.
Yeah.
That's your bare one. If you don't have that, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
The second requirement is you have to have a motherboard that boots UEFI.
Mm-hmm.
So the other method of booting, which is the traditional method of booting, is via the BIOS.
Yeah.
The BIOS is very legacy. It's been around for 25, 30 years, you know, ever since really the beginning. And UEFI is the extension to that. It's a new method of programming.
Fairly recent. So if your motherboard is, what, maybe a year old, 2 years old?
Oh, I mean, really, UEFI has been around for the better part of the decade, really since the millennium.
What's the best way to check if your motherboard has UEFI?
If you're an OEM system, HP, you know, Dell, whatever, go check their website. They're the only ones that are going to have the information. If you have a home-built system, then check the motherboard website. Plug in your serial number, and they'll be able to tell you. Many motherboards will actually ship as BIOS and have a firmware flash that will enable UEFI.
Mm-hmm.
So you can also check for that. So you need to have a 64-bit OS. You need to be able to boot UEFI in order for the system to see the 3-terabyte drive and boot to it. The other requirement is you need to format it as a GPT system.
Mm-hmm.
Once you format it as GPT, it will it addresses it different than MBR. There's a general white paper off of Microsoft's site that talks about basic and dynamic disks. You want to do it as a dynamic disk booting GPT partition style. And doing all of those, you should be able to boot without a problem with a 3 terabyte system. However, don't count on using that on an XP system or on a 32-bit OS. You can't just pull it out, pull the drive out, and use it with any other OS.
Yeah.
So data recovery might be an issue. If you have a problem, you'll need another Win7 64-bit system that boots UEFI to be able to see that drive.
And what if you're building your own system and you build a RAID? Is there anything different that you need to know for that?
The RAID controller has to, of course, support more than 3 terabytes. You'd have to check with the, depending on whether or not you're using the motherboard RAID controllers or a third-party add-in card RAID controller, they'll all have different requirements. Sometimes the normal motherboard will be fine, but their RAID ports will not be fine.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of research. There's no real easy way to figure it out, unfortunately, without reading a bunch of documentation.
So if you built your own system, you want to keep your motherboard book handy anyway. I would have mine on a shelf.
Absolutely.
So you can always reference that. Hopefully it says something about that, but other than that, maybe a search for
your
motherboard type.
And if you get any system board or virtually any system board built in the past 2 years, you know, that's a pretty good indication that you're going to be okay, especially the higher-end motherboards, the really high-end Asus motherboards. I tend to like them. I build my system with Asus motherboards, Zotac motherboards.
I like Tian.
Yep, Tian is a great motherboard. They're really... It's very difficult to find a really bad motherboard, so...
Nice. All right, good. All right, so next question from Bu Abdallah Abdel Momen. What happens when you force shutdown? This is a good question. And is it healthy to do it frequently? I mean, obviously you don't want to do it anymore than you have to. But is it healthy to do it frequently, or should I exit each individual application manually and then shut down again?
So I'm guessing what he is talking about is when you're shutting down the system and you get the black screen listing the application saying, you know, waiting for this program to shut down, and then you can choose force restart.
Just force it to shut down and forget about all the apps.
So... it all depends on what those applications were and what they were doing at the time. So if you have an application like Notepad where you were just viewing a document, you weren't editing anything, then yeah, go ahead, terminate it. It makes no difference, really. You weren't persisting any of the data, you didn't care about the data, so you can shut down that process.
Is it going to leave anything on the drive, like a open fragment or something you need to
ultimately
do a check disk when you restart?
So I'll get to the check disk part.
All right.
It is good that you brought it up. If you have something like your mail up and running, Outlook, traditionally Outlook had this real problem in the past in earlier versions where updates would come along. I think you've experienced this. I've experienced this at work. Our machines that are joined to the domain, the IT department will push out updates, and in doing so, will usually force a system reboot.
It's like a mama bird feeding a baby bird.
Forcefully.
Forcefully.
Yes.
Yeah.
So oftentimes people will come back to their desk, they'll say it's rebooted, they'll groan because, you know, whatever work that they had running, it may or may not be saved, depending on the type of application. And then they'll start up their Outlook, their email, which is basically the lifeblood. You know, everybody uses it very frequently. I've got an entire monitor dedicated just to Outlook.
Yeah.
it runs nothing else. And then the first thing they'll see is checking PST.
Yeah.
Now, anybody with large PSTs, this is the personal folder for your Outlook email that's saved on the hard drive. If anybody has large PSTs, this can take a long time to check. And the problem was because Outlook did not shut down properly. Outlook did not shut down properly, and it wasn't able to close out its data file. So on the next run, it says, oh, I didn't close out the data file. I need to go check that data file.
Yeah.
That's one of the problems with the forced restarts. Anytime you terminate a process that is not able to properly clean up after itself, you run the risk of data corruption. You run the risk of leaving temporary files around.
Yeah.
So
now, one point on that, though. This is one of the reasons why I used to do short to-do lists in Notepad.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't remember to save them, you can lose them if you lose your machine for whatever reason. This is now why I use Outlook for my to-dos,
mm-hmm.
because you'll be saved as a draft. So if I come back to my machine, it's been shut down for whatever reason.
Yep.
At least I've got it in my drafts.
Absolutely. So
continue.
Yeah, that you know, talks about the types of applications that you're shutting down. You know, whether or not they save state automatically. If you're working on a long Word document, it'll save. I usually change mine to save every minute.
Mm-hmm.
It's default every 10 minutes or every 15 minutes, something like that. It's not safe. It's not the best thing to do to force applications to quit like that, because they're not able to clean up after themselves. Yeah. It also usually takes longer for the system to shut down as opposed to just closing out all your apps first and then restarting, because they got to wait on the applications.
Yeah, it's waiting for it to hang and throw an error, kick an error for you.
Exactly. So it's no different than, you know, right-clicking in Task Manager and terminating the process. There's fundamentally no difference. It won't corrupt the drive because you're not doing like a forced power off. Forced power off is very different. This is still a well-behaved shutdown. It's just a forcefully terminating anything that hasn't responded to the system to shut down on its own. So,
and what about check disk?
So with check disk again, that one won't happen unless you've forcefully powered it off. If you've you know, held down the power button for more than 5 seconds to turn it off and turn it back on again. Or if you had a power failure, those are usually the only times you'll get a check disk error. If you if you've improperly shut down Windows, so the forced restart is not improperly shutting down Windows. That's properly shutting down Windows.
Yeah,
it's just not properly shutting down the applications that were running on Windows at the time.
So one of the things that a user might encounter is where you go to shut down and it says shutting down Windows, and then it just hangs there for what seems like too long, like, let's say, hours. At what point do you decide, I'm just going to kick the power off, which always terrifies me to do that anyway. And how bad is that? What should you do when you restart? And is there anything you can do to prevent that? And how long should you wait?
I mean, clearly it's not recommended, you know, to forcefully shut it down, especially while applying updates.
Yeah.
So you really want to take the worst case scenario there and just leave it alone for as long as it may take. You even leave it overnight if you have to.
Yeah.
Because you just run additional risk if you shut it down, you know, just 1 second too early. If you just let it go for one more second, everything would have been fine.
Yeah.
You never really know that. There'll never be a case where Windows takes 24 hours to shut down.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen. You know, it shouldn't take more than 2 hours to shut down, or 45 minutes, or 5 minutes. It all depends on what was happening at the time.
Yeah,
and which is,
probably depends on the machine, too.
It depends on the machine. It depends if updates were being installed. You know, you just have to be more careful. If it was just a standard shutdown, you know, nothing was going on, you weren't having pending updates or anything like that, and it's still taking forever, then you kind of have to, at some point, cut your losses and, you know, you power off the machine.
Yeah.
Now, Windows is really good about recovery.
Yeah.
You know, so you shouldn't, especially at the shutdown point when you're not installing updates, you shouldn't actually have a problem when you're coming back up again. You'll just get the warning that said, Windows didn't shut down correctly. What would you like to do?
Yeah.
It'll say start up in safe mode, whatever. I usually just ignore that and I say start up normally and just, you know, see what happens.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Good question, though. Next question. If I insert a thumb drive and look at files on it, is there anything left behind on the system that would show what files are on the USB drive or the files that I viewed?
Yes and no. There is no method of just, you know, typing in a command that says show all viewed files.
Yeah.
You know, there's no simple method to see what you've accessed, everything that you've accessed.
Yeah.
There are fragments, there are hints that are left over in different areas that could
What are some of those areas?
So there's the recent file list, essentially.
We don't have to look at that.
there is a recent file list.
Yeah, and you can turn that on or off in your start menu settings there, too.
Yep. What else? It depends on the programs that were accessed. They may have their own individual recent.
So like Word will have a lot.
Yes. And, Word, Media Player, they will all have information that has been left over, like media files, number of plays, that kind of thing.
But if you stick a thumb drive in your computer, your IT department's not going to, you know, be alerted to every file that's on there unless they have some other system on there on your computer.
So by default, Windows won't care.
Yeah.
Now, you could have AV software, you could have monitoring software installed on the machine.
Mm-hmm.
That could go ahead and index that entire file system and know exactly what's on there. But by default, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You can turn on auditing for particular files. It's a security mechanism that's in Windows and it'll tell you when file accesses are logged. If you have AV software, it probably has some sort of logging mechanism, whether it's externally visible or internally to, you know, for troubleshooting information, that'll tell you which files were accessed and when.
Mm-hmm.
But there, like I said, there is no easy, highly visible method of knowing exactly, you know, what all the files were on the USB drive if it's already been removed.
Yeah.
Just hints.
Okay, cool. All right, so next question. How can I find the largest files on my D drive with Windows 7? Are there any quick commands? We've talked about this before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like WinDirStat.
It
shows graphically. It's the biggest block on there. It's going to be your biggest file.
Mm-hmm. I prefer that tool as well. It's actually very fast. You can do it from a CMD window if you really wanted to. You can go dirwack OS. You can sort it by size. Yeah, smallest first. So I actually have to be in a directory that has some files in it.
There's your biggest.
There's your biggest in this particular directory. Now you can do that from the root of the drive and search all subdirectories. I'm not going to do that here. It's going to take too long.
Yeah, or you can use an app like WinDirStat. I know Andre1981's got one that he likes too. So
yep. There's like File Commander. There's lots of third-party file utilities that'll check that out.
Cool. Okay. CMD, regedit, msconfig, and other system utilities close immediately after I open them. After restarting Windows, the folder option hide extensions for known file types is checked. All utilities seem okay in safe mode. I think that my Windows is infected with some kind of malware. I'm not able to find any. Is there anything I can check to get the settings back to their normal form?
There's a couple of ways that I would attempt to troubleshoot this before just flattening the system. That is really the only foolproof method of getting rid of malware.
Yeah.
You flatten it, you format it, you load from backups, and hopefully those are not infected with anything. That's the bottom line. That's our policy here.
Go to your last known good as far as installs. Don't restore off your home server from last week's backup if you were having the problem last week, obviously.
There's a couple of things you can do, like create a new user. A new local user and see if it repros with that user as well,
because mm-hmm.
then you can at least isolate it down to a per user versus per machine kind of thing. Those particular utilities would be the types that are targeted by malware to not allow execution.
Yeah.
So you could have had a filter driver installed on the system, a rootkit of some sort. If you're really concerned that it was malware, we have an online safety scanner, the Microsoft Safety Scanner, if you can get here. There are a bunch of third-party alternatives as well. It all just, you know, having to go there, download the tool, run it from a USB stick or a CD-ROM or whatever. This one you can run from your browser. And it's essentially, you know, Security Essentials, the same engine, up-to-date definitions. It'll scan your machine, and if it is malware, it'll hopefully uncover it.
Mm-hmm.
Without actually taking a look at the machine, figuring out what was installed, you know, we could take a look at event logs, we could take a look at a whole bunch of different aspects of the system in order to figure out, you know, how to get this back into a good state.
Yeah.
The other option that you can do if you are convinced that it's not malware and it repros with another user created on the system is if you have the DVD, the actual setup DVD for Windows, you can do an in-place upgrade. Basically, it just runs reinstall over the exact same setup. It'll lay down all the all the settings that a clean install would, but it does not affect your applications
mm-hmm.
or your data. They're all safe. Your device drivers may be reset to inbox versions of the drivers, but it'll get your system back to a bootable, known good state. Assuming there is no malware.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, next question. This almost seems like something you would read in an email forward that's just not true. So, can you really cut CO2 emissions by switching from XP to Windows 7?
Perceptibly or imperceptibly?
Well, let's go with either.
Windows 7 is more efficient than XP, but there are a bunch of different factors involved.
Yeah, like there's a ton of caveats.
There's a ton of caveats. There's the hardware on which it's running on.
Yeah.
You know, if you compare a an OEM machine that shipped with Windows 7 versus an OEM machine that shipped with XP 7-8 years ago.
Yeah, and it's been upgraded.
They're going to be vastly different because the hardware is vastly different.
So the hardware usually gets more powerful and less power consumptive.
Exactly.
So, that's the first reason there. If you have a newer machine, obviously you're going to have better performance and probably better power savings. But it all depends on the hardware. It also depends if your power source that in your wall is coming from a CO2 source.
Sure.
Or if you have a solar or a wind farm by your house. So there's caveats there. I looked this up though, and Infotech does have a PDF on this, and they talked to some of the different power management things. And there was a lot of overhauling that happened with Windows 7 for power management. You want to talk about some of those?
Oh, we basically cut down on the number of services that are always running on the system, that are always taking CPU cycles.
Yeah.
So it's all about, what is actually running and utilizing CPU cycles on the machine at any given time. People will have 8-core systems, 2.2 gigahertz 8-core systems that are super, super duper powerful. But really, no one ever wants their CPU maxed out at 100% all the time.
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird thought process in my mind. We want all this power, but we don't ever really want it used.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what Windows strives for, is a decent user experience, a very good user experience, without actually taxing the CPU, which means a minimum number of CPU cycles to do something.
Unless you're specifically trying to do that, like rendering a video.
Right.
And if I go to render a video on this monster machine here, it sounds like there's a turbo prop shooting out the side of it. So, obviously, it's using everything it's got.
Right.
Awesome. Okay. So, it is, we've myth-busted this one, and it is true.
If you want, real scientific methods.
We'll let third parties do the science, but there is some validity there.
Anontech has great benchmarks.
Yeah.
They do a really good job in getting those types of benchmarks.
Okay, and here's one that's probably started from an email forward. Someone changed the amount of cores running on my computer. I have an Intel i3, and he's pretty sure it only has one core, which we won't even get into that, but he has Windows 7. He searched msconfig and ran it. He clicked on the boot tab, clicked advanced options, changed the amount of cores running from 1 to 4. He needed to restart his machine, and now it won't run Windows 7. He's tried 2 system restores and last known good. Talk about this. This is something that you might see in an email forward.
I've in fact seen this before multiple times. The BCD, the boot option that the person was looking at is right here. If you go to boot,
advanced
options, you have
number of processors
here.
So, this has more than one processor, but it's probably not a good idea to touch that.
No, the entire point of this particular field was for multi-core or multi-processor machines. If there is a problem, this is for debugging purposes, to take it down to one core and figure out, multi-threaded issues on multi-core, multi-processor systems.
Yeah.
That was the design of this.
Mm-hmm.
You never want to change this. This is a 4-core machine.
Mm-hmm.
A 4-processor 8-way machine.
Yeah.
So you just don't want to mess with this field at all.
Yeah, and so this is just for boot, right?
This is what...
Because it's going to use all the cores when Windows starts.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
So you're not going to have any benefit into your work day by changing this anyway.
Absolutely not. Now, in order to recover from this, because currently the machine is not bootable, obviously a reinstall is something perfectly valid, time-consuming to do. What you can do is, if you have the DVD that Windows comes with, boot from it. You get to the splash screen, and here's a troubleshooting hint with the setup DVD. Is that it's really a WinPE CD?
Yeah.
Windows pre-install environment. It's basically a live OS. So when you boot from it, you get the splash screen. You hit next on the splash screen, and then you do Shift F10, and that'll get you a command prompt.
Yeah.
From there, you can go down to the command prompt, type in BCD edit. set. This is a GUID ID of your particular boot entry. You can get that from bcdedit whack enum.
Mm-hmm.
Get the particular boot ID from the hard drive version.
Yeah.
And set your numproc back down to 1.
Okay.
I have no idea whether or not their core i3 system was multiproc capable or not.
Yeah.
But this will at least take it down to whatever it was previously set to.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's a little bit of a hosing there. Don't monkey with that.
And, right. You should never, ever touch that. The system, as part of the boot process, will always boot with 1 CPU.
Yeah.
Because it needs 1 CPU to boot, and then we'll initialize the rest of the CPUs accordingly when the right time.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. All right, next question. Windows 7 runs slow on my netbook. It's Atom 280N. Any tips for improving general performance of Windows 7 on netbooks?
Yeah. You can run it with the basic themes.
Mm-hmm.
You can
turn off Arrow.
Turn off
Arrow.
Even
on.
Probably not. Not on that machine.
Yeah.
The N280, if I'm not mistaken, is a single core system.
Yeah.
So it's generally going to be pretty slow.
It's pretty low end, so pretty don't expect end. It to be fast even on its best day.
Right. In terms of, you know, background software, you know, reduce the amount of background software that you have. If this was a purchase machine, wipe it out, get mm-hmm. rid of some of the...
Uninstall everything that you possibly can.
Yep. Go for a lighter weight virus scanner like Security Essentials. Install the chipset utilities that came with it, though, because
yeah.
usually those have some extra power management, any additional utilities that's required for the netbook itself.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay, good tips. All right, next person. I want to connect my Pocket PC to Windows 7. What do I need to get it working? And they haven't defined what version of Pocket PC that they've pulled out of some old box in their closet. But if you want to use a Pocket PC on Windows 7, where do you start there?
Depending on which version of Windows Mobile it is, you may not be able to.
Yeah.
So if it was Windows Mobile 5 and below, you could only use ActiveSync.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, you had to use the Microsoft Windows Mobile Device Center.
Yeah.
So it says 6.1 for Windows Vista. It actually works on Windows 7 as well.
And if you have one that requires a previous version, will using like XP mode or anything get you there?
Yeah, so you'd have to run XP mode. Then you'd have to map the USB port.
Yes.
There is no hope of using serial. You know,
yeah.
if you have such an old device, it was only serial connectivity.
Yeah.
That won't work. But you can definitely map the USB port. In fact, I've done this before.
Yeah. Windows XP mode is awesome. It's one of the most awesome things.
It is certainly useful for this type of scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, I have an old scanner that I use
mm-hmm.
because it only has XP software. And I love the scanner, so when I do have to hook it up, when I pull it out of the garage, it's mm-hmm. going to XP mode, and it's just beautiful. It works. So.
Interesting.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So that's what you can do. I'll give you a couple options there. Next, I need to disable arrow effects for a standard guest user in Windows 7, but I still want it enabled for the administrator, and I have an administrator account, but I don't know how to do this.
So basically what you do is you just log in to the standard user account,
mm-hmm.
and you just change their personalization settings. So you go to personalize, and you know you have arrow themes as the, you know, the first one to use. And then you just go down, you know, to Windows 7 Basic.
Yeah.
And that will turn off Arrow. You can go down to Classic
mm-hmm.
if you really desperately wanted to. And then you just save it. And then whenever the standard user logs in, this is what they get.
Yeah.
When you're an admin, that's what they get.
Or so just logging Arrow. Back in, it's going to always retain that setting.
Yeah.
Now, I would imagine here, if they have an administrator account, there might be kind of a power struggle thing going on. Maybe they're the IT administrator for their company. Is there any way to force someone to stay in that mode?
Through group policies, you can dictate
okay.
what to use.
All right. So we'll leave it at that, and of course they can Bing for that, or write us again if you have trouble. We'll help you out. We're here
yeah,
for
generally
it.
Speaking, for themes though, you know, it is a user setting,
yeah.
so we tend to just let people and use their user settings.
It could be, too, that maybe they're gaming and they want a profile that's set up without Arrow, you know, for gaming or something like that or some other thing that they're doing.
True. They should be, you know, aware, you know, for newer games that might actually take advantage of Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
Or, well, not necessarily Arrow theming, but the DWM, the composition part of Windows.
Yeah.
So they might not get any kind of perf benefit.
Yeah. Okay. Next, I have an occasional strange sound playing on my Windows 7 PC. How can I determine what app this is coming from? That'll drive you crazy.
Yeah, it would.
You don't know what app is dinging and donging in the background. I missed it again.
The sound applet that comes with Windows can actually tell you this. So if you right-click your speakers, actually just click your speaker and choose Mixer.
Yeah.
This will
show you every application that you've got that's
currently outputting sound.
Yeah.
So, and if an app was ever running,
mm-hmm.
it won't necessarily show up. It'll clean up after a period of time of closing down the audio stream. But, it'll show.
And it gives you a little visual notifier, too, that an app has done something. So if you leave this up and you're just sitting back and you hear that sound, you should be able to see it there.
Sure. So I just started up Windows Media Player. And boom, it showed up here in the mixer.
Yeah.
And I've got it muted, but if I hit play, you can see the gray bar, and it is dynamically changing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you'll be able to figure out apps that are using the audio service, and it'll show it to you.
So leave your volume mixer up, and that'll help you troubleshoot that problem. Nice.
Yep.
That's a good, easy fix for that. All right, cool. So... let's see, I've got Windows 7 installed on my HP Mini 720, and I want to use it as an e-reader. I want to rotate my display for this, but Control-Alt-Arrow doesn't work on it. Are there any other utilities or anything else he could try? Well, first of all, we learned something new today, because neither of us had tried Control-Alt-Arrow before, and I will remember that one now.
That's pretty cool.
That's nice. I like that.
I tend not to change my orientation of the screen.
And left and right arrows, does it do clockwise and counterclockwise? So you can go back, you don't have to go all the way around?
No, you don't have to go all the way around.
That's awesome. I really like that. Okay, good. But for my main machine, you know, tablet PC, I've got a button, a little hardware button on it, so nice. Okay, so if this doesn't work, what do you think the problem is? The first thing is probably update the graphics driver.
Yeah.
See if there's a newer, better graphics driver.
If there's a newer, better graphics driver, the graphics driver itself has to support it.
Yeah, and if Control-Alt-Right arrow doesn't work, it doesn't sound like it's supported.
Potentially not with that hotkey combination. The driver itself might have its own method of rotating the display. I know NVIDIA graphics drivers definitely have that for supported chipsets.
Yeah.
The other thing they can do is actually roll back the drivers to in-box version of the drivers and see if that works.
Mm-hmm. But if that doesn't work, then you might be out of luck on that.
You might be out of luck.
Okay. Maybe do a search online, see if anyone else has gotten that to work. But not looking hopeful on that. All right, next question. In Windows 7, 64-bit, I killed Explorer EXE and then via the task manager do file run dot. This method has always caused the start menu to reappear, but it doesn't do it now. After killing a rogue Explorer EXE process, what's the best way to restore the start menu?
So I would actually make sure that they cleaned up all of the Explorer processes. So if they've actually set it up so that they view folders in separate processes of Explorer,
mm-hmm.
they might not have got them all.
Yeah.
So make sure in Task Manager that you kill off all the explorers and then actually explicitly type in c:windows-explorer.exe.
Yeah.
So that will forcefully instantiate.
And type that in where?
Oh, so under...
Because if you don't have a start menu...
If you don't have a start menu, you can always get to Task Manager with Control-Shift-Escape.
Yeah.
So you want to go File, New Task, and then, you know, c:windows Explorer EXE.
Yeah.
So that would be a method of doing it.
Yeah.
Finally, after that, if that still doesn't work, they can do shutdown WAC-I, which will at least restart the system for them.
Yeah.
So that is at least a cleaner method of
shutting down. So logging off, logging on, is that good enough?
Yeah, logging off and logging on will be good enough.
All right. Cool. Okay, so that's best way to do it. All right, and now we're down to Pick of the Week. And last week we had Sugru, the hacker the hardware hacking segment of the show. This week we're going to do another hardware hacking segment for our pick of the week. And this is 8020.net. This is amazing stuff. So this is like an Erector set for adults, and you can build anything you want. You can see they have a massive hardware catalog here. And these are all pieces that kind of, for the most part, snap together. If you've seen Clint Ruckus and any of the things he's built, like, you know, the Kinect-driven chair and stuff mm-hmm. like that, a lot of that is made out of 8020 stuff. If you look at some of our campus tours for Microsoft Research, you'll see there's a lot of it over there. If you go over and look at some of their areas, you'll see, like, you know, tables and desks and stuff just made out of this stuff. So incredible product there that you can make almost anything you can dream up with. So very cool.
I mean, it's great for lightweight extruded aluminum. You know, you don't have to worry about welding it. They have tight joint seals.
Yeah.
So it's really strong.
Yeah, and there's inserts for like panels and stuff that you can slide in there. Of course, you can make your own. So mm-hmm. I mean, you can now make that dream desk that you always wanted.
Isn't that what everybody really wants?
Yeah.
You know, they go to IKEA. Or, you know, any place where they sell desks, and they go, oh, if it just had this, if, you know, if I could just do, like, a flush wall mount and not actually have anything underneath, you know, and with this kind of stuff, you can actually do that.
You can do it. It'll cost you more in an IKEA, but...
Yeah, but at least it'll be yours.
It'll be yours. It'll be something that you design. So that's a pick of the week for this week, and if you have any questions, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com, and we're going to be off for a couple weeks. You're going on vacation.
I am taking a... much-needed rest and relaxation
and
recharge.
I can't believe they're allowing this to happen. Are you going to change your oof message?
I haven't decided. I'm still going to technically be online, so if they phone my office number,
then
they'll be able to get a hold of me.
No, actually go offline. You got to. You owe it to yourself. At least once a decade, you got to go offline.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see how bad it gets.
All right. Well, we'll be back in 3 weeks, and we'll see you then. Send your emails in, and we'll get to your questions. Thanks for watching.